So here's a factory, and the factory makes bombs. Here's a bomb. Each bomb has a handle on it, a handle, so you can move it around carefully. And it has a trigger. And there's the trigger. And the key thing about the trigger is that if any particle of any kind whatsoever hits the trigger, then the bomb explodes. Okay. And the only problem with this factory is that their manufacturing process isn't perfect. And so sometimes they make bombs like this. Identical, except that the trigger is missing. Okay. So, quick summary for the late arrivals. We have a factory. They make bombs. The bombs are, this is the right course, by the way. The bombs have a trigger. Okay. And the trigger is so sensitive that if a single particle of any kind whatsoever hits the trigger, the bomb will explode. But sometimes they make bombs which don't have a trigger. The manufacturing process is imperfect. And just for the sake of having some nomenclature, let's say these are good bombs and these are bad bombs. And the problem is to design a mechanism which is capable of detecting whether you have a good bomb or a bad bomb. Now, it doesn't matter if, in the process, you explode some of the good bombs. But we want it to be the case that after we've gone through this process on an ensemble of bombs, we have some bombs left over which haven't been exploded, and we know that they're good bombs. Okay. We want to have some bombs left over. We know they're good bombs, and they haven't been exploded. And it seems that this is impossible because the trigger is so sensitive, if any particle hits the trigger, the bomb will explode. It seems like this should be absolutely impossible. Okay, so I'll leave that problem there for the time being, and I'll come back to it. And so what I'm going to talk about today is interferometers. Oh, I should say just a few preliminary remarks. There isn't really a suitable book for this course, so I'm sorry about that. There's previous lectures I've given previous years, which will be similar to this year. Also lectures given by other people have lectures in this course, like Rob Speckens and Matt Leifer. So you can find those on Pursa from previous years. Interruptions are welcome, so if there's something I say which doesn't make sense, then I'm very happy to take interruptions. I'm going to try and make everything sufficiently simple, because the key point is to focus on the conceptual ideas, but I'll try to keep everything simple, so if you don't follow something, then please do interrupt. I'm planning to have office hours on Friday. Fridays from 1 to 2. Okay. Okay, interferometers. Okay, let's see if this works. Oh. Okay. Oh. I want the one that is, this is the front, I want it to go to the top. Try that.
No. Nope. Oh, what's going on?
No, it wants to do something. Do these normally work?
Yeah.
Okay, manual.
Oh.
Okay. Okay, good. So I'm going to talk about interferometers in this lecture, and of course, that will be the resolution to the bomb problem. I'll come back to that towards the end. And interferometers are nice because they're a way to look at essentially finite dimensional Hilbert spaces, but in a way which is a bit more physically intuitive. So let me just go through the basics. So first of all, so I'm going to look at interferometers that have just a single particle. This particle could be, you know, any quantum particle, really. The experiments that are done typically use photons, and there's a lot of really nice apparatuses available that you can use to do single photon interferometry. Although I'm going to sort of present it in a kind of idealized fashion, in a Gedanken fashion. Gedanken, that's the German word for thought, like a thought experiment. So these will be very idealized, an idealized presentation of interferometry. So let me just present the basic elements. So first of all, we have a source. And we can imagine the source has a button on the top. And you press the button, and out comes the particle. And then we'll represent the state of the particle by a ket with an S inside it. Next, we have a length of path, certain length of path. And if a particle travels along a length of path L, then it will accumulate a phase. So it'll accumulate a phase, which is this here. And in the diagrams I draw, I'm typically going to assume that L is a unit multiple of the wavelength. And so we can just ignore this. OK. Next is a phase shifter. So this would be, in the case of photons, it would be a piece of glass of some thickness. And the thicker it is, the bigger the phase. And that will just cause a phase appear in front of the ket. Next, a mirror. So we have so here I'm going to assume these paths have labels. I'm going to assume that when you reflect off a mirror, you get a phase so that you have an eye in front. This is really just a convention, and it doesn't matter because every mirror is going to be different, and you can just change the paths in the immediate vicinity of the mirror so that you accumulate a phase anyway. So this is just a convention. And I choose this convention to be consistent with the convention I choose for beam splitters, which will come up next. Yep. Is this all, everything straightforward so far? OK, so a beam splitter. So here's a beam splitter. So in the case of photons, a beam splitter is a piece of glass which has partial silvering on the back. And so you can send a particle in, and it'll be reflected or transmitted. Do it from this side as well. So, if you send a particle in here, we'll have a reflected part and a transmitted part. And That's like this. So associated with the beam splitter will be a transmissivity and a reflectivity, C and R. And we're going to assume that T and R add up to one, so there's no loss, which is a pretty good approximation for photons with partially silvered mirrors. And this, we assume this phase I, you get this extra phase I when you have a reflection. So here. Yeah. Now we have for B, similar thing. This time we reflect from B into C. So we have the I here. One thing that's important is that the this is a unitary process, a unitary evolution here. Okay. Is it clear to anyone that that's unitary? Can anyone see why that is unitary?
Because the outcome is orthogonal.
Say again, sir.
Because the outcome of the two orthogonal is two orthogonal.
Yeah, good, exactly. Yeah. So. These are orthogonal initially. Okay, and then if you look at these two here, you can if you take the inner product, you can see you get get the right answer. Well, you have to take the inner product like this. So if take put this one over here, then we get we take the complex conjugate, so that's C. C minus, because we've taken the conjugate. And then if you multiply that, you get zero. Those are orthogonal. Every so often in the literature, somebody will write down the wrong a transformation for a beam splitter, which is non-unitary. And when you do that, you can do surprising things, signal faster than light. And then those people sort of demand a Nobel Prize. So it's always good to make sure you have the right object here. OK. Then we have detectors. So a particle comes in, it hits a detector. And we'll treat this like this. We'll say that the particle comes in initially and the detector is in a kind of ready state, so it hasn't fired. Represent that by zero. And then afterwards, the particle is absorbed by the detector and the detector goes into an excited state, which we'll represent by D.
Is that a tensor product between two states?
Yeah. So, I mean, you could put a tensor product in there. Typically, I don't do that because I need to. You can also imagine detectors that don't absorb the particle. They look like this. The particle comes out. And then what you have is this. So it's possible, in principle, that this detector exists. So the particle goes through, it excites the detector, and the particle's state remains unchanged. Okay, this can exist in principle. And the reason that can exist is because you can complete this into a unitary transformation. Okay. So those are all the sort of elements of interferometers for a single particle. Any questions?
What is the difference between D0 and D here? Like
when the idea is that D, this is the excited state of the detector.
So like you're saying that the state of detector after crossing this particle would change, but the particle state wouldn't change? Or?
That's right, yeah. So the detector would click in some sense. And so and so this is the excited state. And you can model this kind of thing. I mean, you can model it, for example, by imagining you have another particle here, which gets excited when the particle passes. Any more questions? Okay. Okay. So I'm going to go through some basic examples. So starting off with the zero example. And this is where you have a source followed by a detector. So you press the button and wait a very short time, and then the detector clicks. And mathematically, it's like that. Okay. Now I'm representing the detector by the simple A. Okay, and here's now the first example. Okay, like this. So now I have a source. I press a button. The particle hits a beam splitter, and it can go be reflected or transmitted. Okay, let's just go through. This is very simple, of course. Sorry. So initially, you have the particle comes in to the beam splitter, and the two detectors are in the ready state. Next, the particle goes through the beam splitter. Oh, and you know what? Just I want to also insert a phase. I'm sorry about this, messing up your notes. I've inserted a phase shifter, phi C and phi B into the paths. Okay. So again, that's very simple. And now your particle is particle is reflected, then the B detector fires and the C detector does not fire. And if the particle is transmitted, then C detector fires, so the B detector. Doing here. This is transmitted. If the particle is reflected, Then it's the other way around. Okay. I've done this right. I've done it the wrong way around. I'm sorry. Good. Okay. So then you can calculate the probability for each of the various possibilities. So the probability that you get B0C, so this one, I've missed here a square root of T, is just equal to T, as it's this amplitude here, the modulus of this amplitude squared. It's just okay. The probability of a round is R, because it's the square modulus of this amplitude. The probability that both detectors fire is equal to zero, because there's no term in there where both detectors fire. And the probability that neither detector fires also is equal to zero. So you have an anti-correlation, either one or the other detectors fire. And then also, so that's one thing to notice. And the other thing to notice is that there's no dependence on the phase in these cases. This is what you would expect, of course. But even this very simple experiment already contains the essence of an argument that was put forward by Einstein, Podolsky, and Rosen in 1935, which is the EPR argument. Okay, so several years earlier, in 1927, Einstein presented what was effectively this situation. This is simplified to argue that there was something he called it a spooky action at a distance. And the reason for that is, if you look at the mathematics, then you have amplitude going along both paths, so this path and this path. And then, so it seems like there's something in both places, but then one of the detectors fires, and therefore instantaneously you know that the other detector shouldn't fire. Okay, but how does the signal, you know, there's nothing in the state that tells you which detector is going to fire at this stage. So how does the information get from one end to the other that this detector has fired and so this one shouldn't fire? Imagine if two people were trying to if you were trying to do this, if you're trying to send a message out from the center and arrange that one person or the other person said yes, okay, the other person said no, then the way you would do that would be to write yes or no on a piece of paper and send it to the left or the right. But here, there's no yes or no written on a piece of paper. This is everything you have. And so it seems Einstein described this as a spooky action at a distance. Okay, we'll come to more of that stuff later. I just want to point out this very simple experiment already has a mystery inside it. Please go ahead.
Sorry, was the point of the phase, was that just for generality's sake?
Or? Yeah, I put the phase in to show that actually it doesn't matter. It's because you take the square modulus, the phase doesn't matter. But of course, when the next example is going to be an interferometer, and then the phase does matter. But go ahead.
Can we have a beam splitter such that instead of just having B and C, we have states which are B tensor C, and it is still unitary?
So you want afterwards? Okay, so afterwards you send something in. What comes out is a tensor product. Okay, so this is an aside, of course. If you have in quantum optics, if you send in a coherent state, so this is the state that's usually regarded as being produced by a laser, Okay, and this state here is actually a superposition of zero photons, one photon, two photons with certain amplitudes in front of it. These are defined to be eigenstates of the annihilation operators. I think I'll come back to that. If you send that in, the state that comes out is actually a product state of coherent states. Okay, so you send this in, then the thing that comes out is, I forget the exact, I think it's over root 2. So you can do that.
So in that case, the probability of BC will not be zero.
Exactly, yeah. In that case, you will have you will not have this anticorrelation. You'll have things detected in both places. And so to actually do the experiment here, this one, although it's conceptually very simple, experimentally it's a challenge because you need a single photon source. And this was done in the in the 80s, late 80s, by Aspect and Grandier and Salibard, I think. Actually, Aspect won the Nobel Prize last year, not for the experiment I'm describing now, but for other stuff. So what they did was they had a single photon source, and I can't quite remember what their source was, but it could have been. What you can do is I'm sort of jumping ahead to stuff that I'll describe probably in the third lecture a bit more. There's certain nonlinear crystals. If you send a laser beam through them, they will convert photons in the laser beam into pairs of photons. And so if you detect a photon here, then you know that you have a photon here. So this is a way of preparing a single photon. It's not quite the same as here, where you press a button. But you know, it's effectively the same thing. You post-select. If this detector clicks, then you know you have a particle here. And then you can send this one onto a beam splitter and do this experiment I described over there. And then you see the anti-correlation. It's not perfect. You'll actually get some coincidences. And so they showed that. The number of coincidences you get are less than you can explain by a sort of classical wave model. Anyway, that's an aside.
Wait, sorry, could this first example, could this not be done, say, macroscopically? If you had, like a little person in a box, and
yep.
you throw them a ball, and they have some probability of throwing it to be some
probability. Yeah, exactly, yeah.
Like
quantum. Now, I would say actually that this is very much a sort of particle property. It's kind of a classical property. What's weird is the way it's described in quantum theory, where it's described not the way you just said, but in fact by having something equally present in both paths, which is not the way you just described it. But it is a classical property. And I would say it's really the conjunction of this classical property with the interference phenomenon that you're going to see in the next example that makes quantum theory weird. Because if this was all you had, then you could describe it by a ball going one way or the other. But it's the fact that you have interference, and to explain interference, you really need to have this. That it's
where it starts to get weird.
Okay. Any more questions? Okay. Good. Then I'll move on to just check. There's nothing else there. Yeah. So I'll move on to the interference. So that was the first example. Second example. So here's an interferometer. We have a source. We have the beam splitter like before, but now we recombine the paths after reflecting them at a second beam splitter, and then we have detectors. And then also we'll put in some phase shifters. Okay. Then I'll label this. This is detector C. So there's a phase shift. So there's a very general interferometer. So it's general because we've got arbitrary, beam splitters, with arbitrary R&T. This is different. And then we have also different phases in the two paths. And I don't want to do that calculation because it's just a bit messy. But what happens then, if you do this, you'll get interference, and the interference pattern will depend on the phase difference and also the is this reflectivity and transmittivities. So I'm going to do some simple examples because I think this will bring out the features I want to bring out. So here's a simpler example. So we have an interferometer has internal paths labeled by U and V, and the paths come out are labeled by D and C. I'm taking this notation from the paper of Elitzer and Weidman, which was published 30 years ago, 1992, that's 30 years. And let's just go through what happens. Okay, so we start off in some initial state. I'm going to, just to make life simple, I won't put in the states of the detectors. It's clear what's going to happen. And then there's a 50-50 beam splitters, so this will evolve. So that. Okay, and now, so that's just after going after the first beam splitter. This is 50-50. This is 50-50. So now we pass through the second beam splitter. So we have to evolve U into here, and then also separately V into here. Okay. So that's the state. And now the interesting thing that happens is you get a minus one in front of the D here, but a plus one in front of the D here. So the D term cancels, and you're left with just the C term. So that's equal to. Happens to have an I in front of it. I should say here, I haven't bothered to put in the phase from these mirrors corners because it's the same on each side. Okay. So what that means is if I put the detector states in, then clearly this means the C detector would click. and the detector never clicks. Okay. One thing that's interesting about this is, if you were to think about this in terms of a particle model, a simple, a sort of naive particle model, you would say, well, the particle comes here, it has 50-50 chance of going this way or this way. Then it arrives here, and it has 50-50 chance of going this way or this way. So by this path, the probability of it getting from here to here, you'd think was a quarter. And likewise, by this path, as you have a sort of situation where but we know it always comes out there. And the reason that's wrong, of course, is because we don't do the calculation. This is the wrong calculation, of course. So more generally, you could have two processes where the probability was p, each process, and then you would think that you would have 2p for the total amplitude, but in quantum theory, you'd have to take the square root of p plus the constructive interference case, and then square it, and then you get 4p. So you're getting twice as big an effect, twice as big an effect as you would expect just from sort of naive classical reasoning. Okay.
Can I ask
yep, go ahead.
The first example, actually.
Yep.
If we had like arms with different lengths in the first example, different lengths to the detector B and C, then we would know that, for example, if detector C wanted to click, if the path is like shorter, we would always know after reaching the C whether B is going to click or not. So there isn't any paradox there anyway. But yeah. I thought that like phase changer also works in the same way. Like changing the length of the arms is just like adding a phase changer, but the probability doesn't depend on the phase changer, and we always have that.
Mm-hmm.
Arms there. But if we have different arms,
mm-hmm.
we wouldn't have such a paradox anymore because we always know the outcome of detector B, for example.
If the path lengths are different, then that's true. But a phase shifter doesn't have to work by introducing a time delay, it changes the refractive index inside the glass. Sort of does it. So I think you could still set things up so that you could have the full range of possible phases, and have the two things space-like separated, so that there is a paradox in that sense.
Can't we look at the difference in the length of the arms as a phase shift?
Yeah, you could do that. Yeah. I mean, to go through the full cycle of phase shifts, then you just need to vary the length very slightly through L, so the two paths can be essentially the same size, same length, but consider small changes to get the full range of phase shifts. It's true. If the two path lengths are very different, then you could imagine a signal being sent. However, the mathematics has no signal in it. It's not. It doesn't look like that. So anyway, sure. Okay. Let me just keep talking about this situation. So So there's another example. Another example is just the same kind of interferometer, but now I'm going to insert a phase shifter in one of the two arms. Where the phase is equal to pi. Okay. So in this case, if you do the calculation, well, it's pretty much the same as that calculation there, except that you've got this high phase shifter. And if you go through that, what it does is it basically it means that you get destructive interference coming into C and constructive interference going into D. So the initial state. Evolves to D. Okay, so now the photon is always detected here instead. So there's an argument from comparing these two interferometers, the one there and the one here, to say that something goes in along both paths. So you might try to have a naive model like the one we were discussing, where a particle comes in and it goes this way or this way. Okay. Let's imagine trying to do that. Let's imagine the particle comes in and it goes along the bottom. Okay. Now it reaches this beam splitter here. And it has to make a choice. Is it going to be detected in C or D? If there's no phase shifter here, then it has to be detected in C, because that's what we had up there. If there is a phase shifter, then it has to be detected in D, if there's a pi phase shifter. Okay. But because the particle went along here, in this sort of naive model we're talking about, it doesn't know whether there's a phase shifter or not, so it doesn't know what to do. Okay, so that kind of model has to fail. Incidentally, If instead of putting this phase shifter here, I put the phase shifter, pi phase shifter here, then we would also get that the particle is detected in D. Okay. So in that case, if the particle went along this path, it wouldn't know about this phase shifter. So it wouldn't know what to do. Okay. Any questions? Very simple. This is really a version of the. You've all heard the argument about double slits. This is just a kind of simplified version of that argument. Okay. There's one more example which I won't do the full calculation, but I'll just discuss it. It's interesting to think about. So this is where you have a source, an interferometer like before, and you have detectors. You have the kind of detectors I discussed before, where you don't absorb the particle. Okay, like this. And so in this example, you know which way the particle went because one of these two detectors will fire. And then you can also look to see where the particle arrives over here. And in this case, the particle will be detected 50% of the time at C and 50% of the time at D. And the reason for that is when you do the calculation, you need to include all these detectors in the state. And so if I can just point up to here. So what happens is now the reason we got destructive interference before was because there was a cancellation over here. But that cancellation doesn't happen anymore because you have different detector states in the two paths, and they're not able to cancel. So that prevents the destructive interference. So if you want to see that for sure, you can go through and do the calculation. I won't discuss this. It may be discussed in one of the problems you get. But there's an interesting phenomenon called the quantum eraser. So what you can do is you can let this particle pass through. One of the detectors fire. Well, one of these detectors could fire, and then you get 50-50 over this. Detector fires, or this one does. And if you arrange things so that the firing of the detector is kept at a quantum level, So it could be, this could be something that goes into an excited state either in this path or this path. Then you can do a subsequent experiment where you interfere this and this. You interfere these two boxes, and you can effectively erase the information as to where it went, whether this detectified or this detectifies. And you can perform a measurement which has one or two outcomes, and in both cases, you erase the information. And then, conditioned on the outcome of that experiment, you can recover the interference. So this is, if you're interested in pursuing, I think it's in one of the problems, this is the quantum eraser. Okay. Right. So let's talk about the Elitzur-Weidman bomb problem.
I just had a question, sort of, to Savas, where if instead of adding a phase shift, we just lengthened one of the paths.
Mm-hmm.
If we could continuously lengthen it, we would see C be like where it detects, then to D and back and forth. But if I lengthen it long enough, shouldn't I be able to use like time discrimination between when I press the button and when it's detected to determine what path it took?
Okay, yeah. So you're saying if I make this length, yeah, that's right, yeah. So the calculations I'm doing here, I'm just keeping everything very simple. I'm assuming a single mode, so a single wavelength. And so actually, then your wave packets are infinitely long. Of course, that's an unrealistic idealization. Strictly speaking, you would have to have a superposition over a bunch of different wavelengths. And then you would have wave packets of some more finite size. Having a wave packet that's long enough, it doesn't really affect very much the interference phenomena, but it's true that if one of the paths is too long, then the two wave packets will fail to overlap when they get here, and so then you'll have exactly what you said. There's an interesting interferometer called the Franson interferometer, which uses kind of superposition in time, so you have wave packets at different times, and it's a clever way to sort of make them superimpose them. I can't discuss that at this stage because I'm not at that stage. Maybe I'll mention it. Running out of time. We'll see. If I get a chance to mention that, I will. It's an interesting interferometer that uses temporal superposition.
Can you write the name of
it? The Franson interferometer. Okay. So the bomb. Okay. So does anyone know how to anyone at this stage can guess how to work out how to solve the bomb problem? No. Go ahead.
I mean, maybe you use like interference to see if it always goes to C or always goes to D.
Okay, yeah, that's the basic idea. So that's basically the idea. Let me show you how it works out. So you take an interferometer, and I'm going to take the simplest interferometer where it's set up so it always goes to C. Okay. Everything is very simple, and we make it so that it always comes to C. So I've used the same notation that Elitzur and Weidman used in their paper, and I think the reason for D was that D stands for dark, because this detector doesn't fire in this standard configuration. So what you do then is you put the bomb, you take the bomb very carefully, of course, by the handle, and you place the bomb there in such a way that if there is a trigger, the trigger protrudes into this path right by dotted lines. There. Okay. Okay. And then you press the button and stand well back. And various things can happen. Okay. So the first thing that can happen is that the particle comes along and causes this bomb to explode. Well, that makes sense because there's amplitude for it going this way and for this way, and it could go this way, hit the trigger, and explode the bomb. Okay. And just a naive way of thinking about that is that a particle comes along here, goes this way, hits the trigger. The second thing that could happen is that detector C fires. Okay. Well, that could happen because there's two paths through this interferometer, so it's possible that, you know, just naively speaking, you could think the particle went this way, reflected, and hit the detector. Okay. If detector C fires, then you don't learn anything, because detector C would have fired anyway if the bomb hadn't been there. Okay. Actually, it's not true you learn nothing. You learn some probabilistic information, but we don't get the answer we want. Okay, so the third option, this is the interesting option, is detector D fires. So if detector D fires, well, that has to mean that the trigger is there. Because if the trigger was missing, then you would have an ordinary interferometer, and if you have without any obstruction, so detector C would have to fire. So if D fires, it means there must be a trigger in there, and so you have a good bomb, but you haven't exploded the bomb.
Particle crosses the trigger to explode anyway.
Well, I can take you through the mathematics. Let's go through it. I'll write bomb zero to indicate the bomb has not exploded. We have two detectors, C in a zero state. So the point is that as I go through this, no particle, there won't be a state where there's a particle hitting the bomb in one of the paths, one of the terms, so it won't explode. Okay, we'll just do this from... Okay, there we are, one. So the next thing that's going to happen is we have to evolve this past the bomb. So if you hit the bomb will explode. But if B over here hits the bomb doesn't explode. So we have... I'm not sure if the rest of the interferometer is destroyed or not when that happens. Maybe not. So maybe the detectors are still here. I over. We get to this state. So there's a 50% chance the bomb has exploded. But we also have this term where it hasn't exploded. And now we take this V through the second beam splitter. So we get the same thing again, the bomb explodes. Simplify that 1/2. I D plus C, and then no, wrong way around, should be here. Yeah, C. So like this, and then the next step, I don't have to write it down, I think it's fairly straightforward, is you can see either of these two detectors could fire, just like the beam splitter example, the first example. And so there's now a 25% chance, because 1/2 squared is a quarter, a 25% chance that detector D will fire, and the bomb hasn't exploded.
Is there a most efficient way to distinguish the bombs?
So, and this is also at least one of the homework problems has been prepared to find a better way to do it. So just in this example, you can change this is a 50-50 beam splitter. Okay. What happens here is you have the three options. If the bomb explodes, then that's finished. If the bomb doesn't explode, you still have another chance to send the particle through again. And so if you keep going round, you'll increase the percentage from a quarter to something higher than a quarter. And you can do even better if you change the reflectivity and the transmissivity on these beam splitters, then you can get a bigger percentage. And in that case, you can get it up to almost 50%, like 50% minus delta. And Elitzer, and so of the two co-authors, Weidmann is a fervent believer in the many worlds interpretation. And he was convinced that the reason for this 50% had to do with the many worlds. There always have to be a world where the bomb explodes. But it turns out you can actually do better than 50% in a different configuration. And I think that's a homework problem, so I won't ruin that for you. You can have the enjoyment of working out that problem. I'm out of time. Any questions on this before we go ahead?
So if the bomb explodes, then the particle is it still like a 50-50 chance it'll go to C or D, or is there?
Oh right. So then you can have. I think the model would probably the best model would be that the bomb absorbs the particle. Okay. We had these two detector models. Where are they? The bomb is basically a detector. Elitzer and Weidmann had the imagination to call it a bomb instead of the detector, because that made people notice the paper. But it's basically a detector. And we have these two different detector models. So I think the most interesting way to do it is to have it where you have the first kind of detector model where the bomb absorbs the particle.
Can you ever definitively say that a bomb is a bad bomb?
Oh, right. Can you say it's a bad bomb? Oh, that's a great question. Answer.
Curious if you like keep it there for long enough and only detect C.
Yeah, but that's you want to have it definitively, so you have absolutely no, there's no chance that it's a good bomb.
If you could, in theory, run it infinitely
if you do it infinitely times, then the probability converges to zero that it's a good bomb. But I don't think there's a way to do it in a finite number of runs. I'm not aware of that. Yeah.
Or you just directly send a particle.
Right. Just directly send the particle. Oh, yeah, that's true. Yeah, yeah, good point. Yeah, of course. Yeah, yeah, that was a zero. Why not? Yeah, of course. So just a zero example. Yes. Okay, good, good. Okay, that does it straight away. Thank you. Okay, so I'll see you.